Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this August 2010 Science News Update. I'm your host for this bloody hot summer evening, Jim Campanella. I don't know about you guys out there, wherever you live, but I'm getting pretty sick of this chronic above 90 degree weather in the Northeast U.S. Jersey has been a steam bath for months, and I'm a bit worried that September will only mean moderation into the 80s. If I wanted to live in the tropics, I would move to Florida. When you hear this, I should hopefully be at a conference slash vacation for a couple of weeks in Oregon, where it is supposed to be much cooler at the moment. I look forward to evenings where the temperature actually drops below 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but at the moment, my thermometer says it is 86 degrees Fahrenheit outside, and it is 8 p.m. Ew. Anyway, let's get on to the first story before I melt. The human body is quite amazing, and the first story just verifies that belief. I've always wondered how women can schlog around all day in 2, 3, or 4-inch heels with minimum foot problems. I suspect that it is male obliviousness that made me think that the problems are minimal, by the way. It is just a thing that most men have not experienced or understand. A new study in this month's issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology by Dr. Marco Nerisi from Manchester Metropolitan University examines not only what happens to women while they wear the high heels on a daily basis, but what happens when they take them off. Doctors have known for a long time that if you hold a limb, an arm or a leg, in a shortened position over an extended period of time, the muscles shorten up. High-heeled shoes push heels up, which made Dr. Nerisi wonder whether wearing heels on a regular basis would shorten calf muscles. According to Nerisi, there was some anecdotal evidence that something changed because secretaries in the 1950s complained about discomfort when they took their heels off and walked flat-footed. Nerisi stated, quote, "I thought it was an experiment which was inadvertently being done by women. What we could do was test high heel wearers to see if we could find some changes in the calf muscle." Nerisi obtained volunteers ranging in age from 20 to 50 years old, who had regularly worn 5-centimeter heels for 2 years or more. He eventually discovered a final group of 11 women who felt uncomfortable walking around without their heels on. Then he recruited a second group of women who did not wear high heels to look at the internal workings of both groups' calf muscles. Measuring the size of the women's calf muscles using MRI, the researchers found that the calf muscles of the high heel wearers were the same size as those of the women who preferred flat shoes. In other words, they hadn't shrunk. Nerisi stated, quote, "We were expecting slightly smaller muscle volumes in the high heel wearers because we thought if the muscle is in a shortened position, then you are loading it less and the muscle volume would be smaller." Unquote. Next, they used ultrasound to measure the muscle fiber length in the women's calf muscles. And this time they did see a difference. The high heel wearers' muscle fibers were 13% shorter than the women who wore flat shoes. That confirmed the hypothesis because when you place the muscle in a shorter position, the fiber becomes shorter. However, by shortening the fibers, the muscles would have to contract more to shorten by the same length. And if this was the case, the high heel fans' calf muscles would no longer function optimally and thus would produce less force than the flat shoe wearers' calf muscles. Essentially, the shortened muscle fibers made it more difficult for high heel addicts to walk efficiently. Scanning with MRI, they found the Achilles tendon was the same length in both groups of women. The tendon had not lengthened to compensate for the shorter calf muscles. However, the high heel fans' tendons were much thicker and stiffer than the flat shoe wearers. Nerisi and his team realized that by thickening and stiffening, the Achilles tendon compensates for the shortened muscle fibers in the calf muscle, allowing the heel wearers' calf muscles to function optimally as they walked, but causing discomfort when walking on flat feet because the tendon can't stretch sufficiently. So should women give up wearing high heels? Nerisi says yes, give them up. But being realistic, he suggests that fashionistas addicted to their Jimmy Choos may want to try calf-stretching exercises to avoid soreness when they kick off their heels at the end of the day. The next story actually makes me jealous of woolly mammoths because they were on Earth when there was an active ice age. Biologists are always curious how animals that live in extreme cold, like that of an ice age, can survive that nasty weather. Now, the woolly mammoth vanished just after the last ice age, but it may be the best understood prehistoric species there is because of its massive size and its demise in ice made for near-perfect fossilization. In fact, the fossil record has illuminated a lot of what we know of this animal regarding anatomical adaptations to the cold. Thick fur, oily skin, blubber, small ears, tail. By the way, those of you who think that the modern elephant evolved from the woolly mammoth would be wrong. The elephant is actually older. The woolly mammoth descended directly from Asian elephants that originated in tropical Africa 5 to 7 million years ago. But as interesting as that trivia may seem, the more interesting thing is the evolutionary question that it brings up about the mammoth evolution to cold. In short, what kind of evolutionary adaptations allowed a massive tropical elephant that was and is excellent at eliminating excess heat to move into and survive the frigid Arctic? Until recently, none of the fossilized evidence could be connected to how this animal once functioned, because physiological and biochemical characteristics do not fossilize. In the most recent volume of Nature Genetics, Dr. Kevin Campbell and his research group from the University of Manitoba examined that very question. In typical mammal hemoglobin, the oxygen-binding protein in the blood releases oxygen with very slight increases in temperature, thus allowing beneficial site-specific oxygen delivery to warm working muscles. However, the hemoglobin of modern Arctic species is insensitive to low temperature. In those animals, the oxygen delivery to cold extremities and appendages is maintained, despite having a warmer core, and that saves energy and minimizes heat loss in those animals. Campbell hypothesized that the woolly mammoth should have similar blood chemistry, but the problem was, how do scientists analyze blood from an animal that went extinct 10,000 years ago? Well, the answer is, ta-da, molecular biology, cloning, and genetic engineering. If you have no blood, you try to isolate the hemoglobin gene and then express the protein in bacteria and then analyze the enzymology of the newly resurrected protein. And that's pretty much what they did. They extracted DNA from 3 permafrost-preserved Siberian mammoths that lived 43,000 years ago. From this DNA, they sequenced hemoglobin genes and converted the sequences into mRNA. They then inserted the mRNA into E. coli bacterial extracts and performed a process called in vitro cell-free expression, which manufactured the mammoth's hemoglobin. Next, the team compared the mammoth protein structure to Asian and African elephants. They found structural differences in the mammoth hemoglobin resulting from 3 amino acid changes. Finally, they performed physiological and biochemical experiments on the mammoth hemoglobin to determine how the structural differences affected function. They found that the mammoth hemoglobin functioned over an extremely wide temperature range compared to that of their modern tropical forebears. This could be due to more chloride binding sites on the molecule. That changes how much heat is released during binding of oxygen. Arctic reindeers possess similar binding sites, and actually elephant hemoglobin has that binding cluster as well built into it, though it's not functional. Campbell's team believes that these 3 amino acid substitutions in the hemoglobin sequence set mammoths apart from their elephant cousins, allowing them to oxygenate tissues even at very low temperatures and preventing costly heat loss. Yeah, we're not talking Jurassic Park here, but hey, this is something pretty cool to find out about a species that's been dead for tens of thousands of years. Humans love the taste of beverages. Some people are very serious about certain types of beverages. I know some people who turn their noses up at Dunkin' Donuts coffee, insisting it is not up to the quality or taste of Starbucks. And other friends who insist that a $7 bottle of wine is the equivalent of drinking urinal water. And yet still other friends who insist that Coke, Pepsi, and Royal Crown Cola all taste alike. Which, by the way, I don't believe. Then there are people I know who insist there's a difference between the various brands of bottled water. You drink store brand water? Are you insane? I only drink Poland Springs. It tastes so much better. Now, until I read the next story, I pretty much discounted that last bit as being, well, less than believable. Although water is essential for us, astonishingly, little is known about how we sense it or regulate its uptake. However, we can learn how we taste water from studying insects, as there is a general agreement among scientists that these little creatures do have a taste for water, even if there is a question of whether humans do or not. A research team from the University of California, Berkeley, led by Dr. Kirsten Scott, has now published a new study in Nature, providing insights into the molecular basis of water taste in fruit flies. Yes, fruit flies, but you have to start somewhere. Fruit flies have a unique set of taste neurons that participate in the detection of various tastes. Among them are also neurons known to respond to water, but by an unknown mechanism. In order to identify the neuron's water receptor, Scott compared gene expression in the mouth parts of the fly between control flies and mutant flies lacking all taste neurons. One of the genes whose expression was significantly decreased in the mutant flies was something called Pickpocket 28, PPK28, which is a gene encoding an epithelial sodium channel. Next, Scott monitored neuronal activities in response to different taste solutions by using a genetically encoded fluorescent calcium sensor expressed in the water-sensing neurons of living flies. She found higher neuronal activities when she stimulated the fly's mouth parts with pure water and lower activity when she applied solutions containing salt, sugar, acid, or bitter substances. The higher the concentration of the added substances, the lower the resulting neuronal activity, suggesting that the water receptor responds to changes in the relative water content, not to the water directly. The mutant flies failed to respond to water, in contrast to the control flies, which did. Moreover, the mutant flies also changed their behavior as they drank significantly less water. Finally, to determine whether PPK28 is directly involved in water sensing, the team inserted the PPK28 gene into human embryonic kidney cells, which do not express any taste receptors. They again recorded calcium signals to monitor whether the kidney cells could detect water. Well, they did. Scott's group successfully conferred this type of responsiveness to human embryonic kidney cells, which again lacked any taste response normally. I guess next time someone insists that Deer Park water tastes better, I won't be quite so quick to dismiss them. Humans may actually be more sensitive to water than I suspected. Next story is appropriate since this year is the 50th anniversary of the birth control pill. For as much good as many people think the pill has done in this world, it has probably caused almost as much suffering. For example, it has been known for years by physicians and scientists, though not highly publicized in the media, that the pill has a strong connection with breast cancer induction. Even more oddly, a study released in early 2010 suggests that mortality in general was increased in the youngest age group of pill users. Women under 30 who took the pill had almost a threefold greater chance of death from any cause than never users. Scientists are still puzzling over that one. But this story has nothing to do with death. It has to do with straight reproduction, or, well, at least to do with sex. Dr. Christine Drea, professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University, has been examining the more subtle effects that contraceptive use can have on mate selection. A dozen female lemurs at the Duke Lemur Center were given monthly injections of the contraceptive Dopa-Provera. Drea's chemical analysis found that the treated animals expressed different scents than intact females, significantly altering the signals females send about themselves to social contacts and prospective partners. In other words, they smell funny. The findings are part of studies that Drea's group has done using chromatography to tease apart the chemical components of the scents produced by lemurs. A female lemur's scent normally conveys not only her fertility status, but also information about her identity, her relatedness to others, and her genetic homozygosity. That is, an indicator that prevents inbreeding between related lemurs. If all that information is scrambled by hormonal contraception, it may in part explain changed pattern of aggression that other studies have noted when captive primates are treated with contraceptives. In this study, there were 12 females that served as both intact and, quote, contracepted animals by being sampled in each condition. Under contraception, the females were found to express some sense that intact females don't, and to express sense in different proportions. The contracepted females also tended to lose their scent individuality. Drea says, quote, there's something very different about these gals. If animals are figuring out who their kin are by scent to avoid inbreeding, they no longer smell like their brothers. In behavioral tests, the 13 males in the study showed clear preference for the scents of intact females, spending less time investigating odor samples from contracepted females. The bigger question is whether these findings are relevant at all for our own species. Humans are known to send and receive olfactory cues about hormonal status and possible compatibility. Drea says, quote, one has to wonder if human mate choice could be affected in the same ways as it has been in these primates. Well, it is something to think about. The last story of the night is not really a story. It's a bit of a departure from my usual straight news stuff. What I want to relate to you guys has to do more with my continued awe at nature and the organisms that are out there in the world. I was at the library the other day with my 4-year-old daughter, Zarabeth. By the way, an oak leaf cluster with brass figligy for anyone who knows what SF source her name comes from. And as usual, I told her to pick out whatever books caught her eye, and we would read them together. Well, among the books she brought back to me was one that had a monkey on the cover called Never Smile at a Monkey by Steve Jenkins. The book was in the picture book section of the children's library. When we later read the book together, I was surprised at its sophistication for being from the section of the library for the youngest readers. The book is essentially a warning for children and adults about dangerous animals that do not necessarily appear dangerous at all and how they should be treated and avoided. I already kind of knew the story of the title of the book. You never smile at a rhesus monkey, well, or most monkeys for that matter, because they will interpret the show of teeth as an aggressive gesture and usually respond violently. Even a small monkey can hurt you seriously because they have long, sharp fangs. It is ironically amusing that humans evolved to show that smile as a way of exhibiting humor. But here are a bunch of other examples of dangerous animals from the book. And these completely surprised me. I had either never heard of them before or thought they were pretty innocuous myself. First, never pet a duck-billed platypus. Why? It's the only poisonous mammal, and it has venomous spurs on its back legs. It's not fatal to most humans, but the jab can literally be intensely painful for weeks at a time. Second, never collect a live cone shell from a tide pool. Why? It has poisonous barbs that can be launched like little harpoons, and the barbs are so poisonous that you can die within minutes of being stabbed. Fun stuff for a 4-year-old, huh? The deadliest is the geographic cone shell from the South Pacific and the Indian Ocean. Their toxins are so potent that when they spear small prey, the prey die almost instantly. Number 3, never jostle a box jellyfish. Why? The box jellyfish, also known as the sea wasp, is said to have the deadliest venom of any animal on the face of the earth. More than 5,000 human deaths have been caused by contact with this seriously nasty creature. Most jellyfish just kind of drift around in the ocean, but the box jellyfish actively swims, and quite quickly, in pursuit of prey. It's the only jellyfish that has eyes, and it has 24 of them. The biggest species of these has a body the size of a basketball and tentacles up to 10 feet long. Number 4. Never stare at a cobra. Why? They can spit venom accurately more than 8 feet, and they always aim for the eyes. The venom causes intense pain and even blindness if you're not treated immediately. Number five, never caress an electric caterpillar. Well, they're not actually electric, but they are certainly quite nasty. They have hairy bristles that are actually small spines, and the spines are filled with poison. They are delicate and can break off into your skin if you handle the little caterpillar. And without immediate medical attention, weakness, severe sickness, and even death can follow. I had no idea that you could actually die from just handling a caterpillar. Let me finish with this warning. Never swim with a squid. Why? Well, a Humboldt squid is bigger than a full-grown human. And this is what I didn't know. Its tentacles are lined with thousands of sharp teeth. Yes, teeth on the tentacles. The Humboldt attacks by whipping those tentacles and teeth around you. Then it tears you to pieces using a combination of those toothed tentacles and its very sharp parrot-like beak. It makes you think of Cthulhu or something. Usually, these animals stay in deep water of the eastern Pacific, but they have been known to attack divers and fishermen. I'm not quite sure my daughter appreciated any of this, except for the pretty pictures of the animals in the book, but I thought it was one of the coolest library finds in quite a while that we have found. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, keep cool, stay away from those squids, and stretch those calf muscles after wearing those red leather Manolo Blahnik slingbacks all day. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.